You're listening to the Hope Shot Recovery Podcast.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Hope Shot. Hope you guys had a great weekend. Tonight we have a great guest. We have Rachel from Addict with Purpose. I'm always excited to hear stories. It gives me hope. I'm going to read the clarity statement. And if you guys don't know what the clarity statement is, it just pretty much lets you know that you're welcome no matter what kind of recovery path you're going through or whatever you choose. You're welcome here at the Hope Shot. Okay, so the Hope Shot clarity statement. We here at the Hope Shot are a group of people in recovery spreading inspiration. We come from all different walks of life and pathways of recovery. Our verbiage may be different at times, but we all have one thing in common. Recovery is a lifestyle. We support all pathways to recovery. It doesn't matter how you get from A to Z, just get there. And thank you for being a part of our family. Let's get right into Rachel's story. You know, Rachel and met online. We are, you know, creators. We collab together. We working together for a common purpose to see how we can help the next person. We'll bring Rachel on. And what's up, Rachel?
Hi. I'm always so chipper.
Yeah, and I think you're chipper because you got the camera to work and you didn't screw it up. Isn't that it?
You pretty much, because I've been sweating it all day. Like, what if the camera doesn't work? What if I have to go on my phone and the phone's like going to be little and not side by side?
Listen, when I first started this, podcasting, recovery stuff, I used to record it for YouTube and have to edit it later. The whole time it's recording, and then I was like, oh my God, did I hit the record button? Oh my gosh, is the video working? What happens if the audio is not working? And like, it was just anxiety the whole time. And I hated it.
Unnecessary anxiety. Yeah, I know.
Unnecessary. I have a lot of that in my life. I'll tell you right now.
Yeah. Story of my life. It's like, I thought that we were going to get sober and the anxiety part of like coming down and having to live miserable was going to be gone. And it's like, no, dude, life's still life. Like, anxiety still happens.
Yeah, and that unprovoked anxiety always is going to come around every once in a while. And I've gotten really good at trying to like recognize when it's starting to come up. I'm like, yo, what are you doing? Yo, we don't need you right now. It's not your turn.
right. Take a breathe. Wait. Nope. Still there.
Nope. Yep.
Still there. Still there. It's always we're going to work through it.
Yep. Exactly.
Awesome. Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me to come on. I love all the work that you and your homies are doing. Like, you guys are doing awesome stuff out there and all over. Like, just, I love when I get to meet people in the community doing stuff right where they live. But then when it becomes nationwide and worldwide, it's just mind blowing, because years ago, you could only find recovery in a room. And today, like, you're doing stuff in Spanish. That is so cool. And hitting the
whole... you've seen that. Technology is crazy, like, yo.
Coming into Spanish. And now people in other countries can literally hear what you're saying or bringing out in their own language. Is like, that's freaking awesome. So kudos to you. You guys are doing the damn thing.
For me, like, I'm one of those, I grew up in a family that addiction did not discriminate from. Everyone in my family, I feel, or a good majority of it is today, gratefully, a lot of them are in the rooms of recovery, but growing up, that wasn't what it was like. My dad was an addict for me growing up. I'm 44, and I think he has 32 years in recovery, and so I grew up in that type. Yeah, that was the environment I grew up in. Was there was a lot of drinking there. My dad was a part of that whole Purdue pill thing. It's his story to tell, so I don't get too into his story, but heroin, pills, that was what childhood was. And he was taught at a young age that you can recover, and this is dangerous, right? He worked in a recovery program that said as long as they would celebrate them by taking them out to go get drunk. So he was like peer support back then, working in a really well-known program. I think it's like a nationwide program now, 40 years ago, but his one drink that they would allow him to have was a gallon of whiskey. And he was like, I get one drink a day. And alcoholism came hardcore too. My sister's an addict. I think this is her, I don't know what she's on right now, to be honest with you. my older sister is in recovery from heroin, opiates, and all of that too. Everybody in my family drinks and drugs, and so we have lots of recovery also. But that, I don't know, that was what it was like growing up.
It's like a family disease. It all stems from the whole family gets it, usually, except for seldom.
Right.
Some few have singled out ones that happen. But most of the time, it's a family disease, and it starts with the parents, and it passes down from generation to generation.
Yeah. Well, and my grandpa was an alcoholic, and his dad was an alcoholic. So I think, like, my dad was first generational substance use, but alcoholism, my mom's dad was an alcoholic. And it was interesting because my dad found this a woman who he was a hardcore partier, and my mom never drank. She never smoked. Per my dad, she tried a cigarette and she got drunk on one of her birthdays and was like, she's the exact opposite of me. I drank. It made me sick. I was sick for 2 days. I never did it again. I was like, drink some more and you won't be sick. It's the complete exact opposite. So it was like growing up in a home with someone who was really naive to addiction and having a powerhouse dad who was like Captain NA. And I was destined to be an addict because my dad already had that mindset set. So we grew up in New York and we had moved to Utah. I think I was 11 when we moved. And we moved because my older sister, I have three sisters. We're all 3 years apart. I have a twin, then a sister who's 3 years older, and then another one who's 3 years older. And at the time, she was dating the neighborhood, like the neighborhood bad boy. And my parents thought, we need to leave. Like, her life is going to be ruined. And they moved us to Utah, thinking that we could run from that they could run for their problems. And that just wasn't the case. My older sister has battled. She just turned 50. And she's been battling her own struggles with addiction since her teenage years. I remember during my addiction, it was really hard. One of the most beautiful parts of it was my older sister at that point had long-term sobriety. I think by the time I had started to get sober, she had just hit 8 years and she never forgot about me. She was always praying for me, hoping that I was going to find my way out of the darkness. And she was probably my biggest supporter because she never gave up on me when the rest of my family did. It was a crazy struggle. Like, I went and experienced homelessness in my early 20s in Manhattan, which was my first round of homelessness. And back then, that was like Jersey Shore type situation. We were like, everybody was doing E and Molly and K. And then meth came into the picture. And that just never worked out good for me. Ever. All those combos continued to always lead me into homelessness. So my first round of homelessness was about 2005 in Manhattan. It was awful. Probably 2003. And then again, starting in 2013, back to homelessness because of meth. Meth destroyed my life over and over again. And I keep trying to think I could do meth, but every time I do meth, I get homeless. It's awful.
Yeah, I grew up in that same era with E and K and all that. And I was always chasing that feeling. I was always chasing that because it was ecstasy. It really was for me. It was euphoric. It was fun. It was love. It was all these things that I've always chased. And I feel like I never could catch that feeling again because I was young. You're talking about 2000s, early 2000s and that late 90s. Man, that's when it was really popping with the ecstasy. And I was always chasing that feeling my whole life. And meth is not the same, but it's close. And it's a dirtier version of it to me. And I think that's where, that's what we're chasing, was that feeling again of the euphoric. But what was it like living in Manhattan homeless? I could imagine living there with a cold and how busy it is.
Oh my God, awful. It was awful. At that age, I was really young. I graduated high school in 1997. Right after 9/11, we had moved back to New York, and I did good for about a year. I graduated hair school, but I was drinking heavily. And for me, when I drink, I go right to drugs. And so then it was like, let's do a little cocaine. Let's do a little bit of E. Continuing to look for that exact feeling you're talking about. It's like your first two or three trips are ones that you try to get back. Then you start taking more and more pills, and more pills never get you to where you were. It was wild. Living like subways were where you stayed warm. I mean, New York clubs don't close until 4 or 5 a.m. You could maintain a little bit because you'd get out of the club and then you'd find somewhere else to go and sleep for a day. And I was like into club promoting and that stuff. So I always found little places to go. But in the winter, it was cold and it was scary. I had times where it was like, I still today think I'm so lucky to be alive, where people were following me off the subways. I was like a 20-year-old and they could tell I was blitzed out of my mind. And people would defend me and they were like, leave that girl alone, stop following her. And I was 20. I just didn't understand the scariness of the world that was out there. Because I was high as a motherfucker, just wanting to hug everybody and tell them how wonderful the world is and rub my arms. It feels so good. but New York was scary. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. It was super scary. And part of my first attempt of trying to get sober, I was in Brooklyn and it was a really cold, rainy night. And I was hanging out with this chick who was, she was just her own version of really sick. And I called my friend who had just, one of my best friends, she had just moved to Connecticut. And I was like, Stacy, I want to get sober. I've had enough. I don't know when the last time I'd slept in, I'd done so much cocaine. I felt the anxiety and my heart was popping out of my chest. And I wanted to die. I wanted to die because of what I was doing to myself. And I didn't know how to stop. And she took me, her and her husband at the time came and picked me up. And I was really excited because I was going to get better. But I had a little baggie left of, like, you can't throw it out. Just in case I'm going to get sober, but just in case I decide. And I did, it was like a $10. It was like two bumps. It wasn't even, in my opinion, it wasn't something to kick me out over. In her opinion, I had 3 days later, I'm like, Stacy, I just want you to know I brought drugs into your house. I'm sorry, but let's throw them out. And she was like, how dare you? I brought you into my home. I came and picked you up. And that was the first time where I just didn't understand, where I learned how damaging I can be to people. And it was really hurtful. She kicked me out and it was going right back to the streets. And that's where I started to live with my kid's dad. I just met him probably like 6 months before and he let me move in with him. And we got married 2 years later. But that was the first time like I thought to get sober and realize how hard it was going to be without working a program. Like, I am the queen of trying to get sober and not working any type of a program. And it continued to show true over and over and over again. Like, I went to my first program when I was 15 years old. And then again, when I was 16, my parents really tried to save me. And so I learned a lot of tools that I'm really grateful for from back then. Because I still use a lot of those tools today. And it was a therapeutic community. And so I felt like I knew what I was doing. But I was trying to get sober alone. Like, you cannot get sober alone. And I figured that out when I finally got sober this time in 2017. That I've got to work a program. I've got a fellowship. I've got to give back.
You know, and that's pretty much how it goes. We sit here and we have our addiction. We try, like we really do want this thing, but we just don't know exactly how we're going to get it or even if it's achievable. So we're trying to do it on our own self-will and we don't have the tools and the resources to actually deal with our flawed character, our defects that are taking us right back out, because you can tame them for a moment because you're like, oh yeah, man, I have a moment of clarity. I'm going to stop. I'm going to move forward. I'm tired of living this way. But everything we've tried, the attempts, it's always, and that's how we repeat cycles, going back and forth, doing the 1-2-3 shuffle, as they call it, where we don't have the tools that are the foundation built solid to where we can build from there. And we keep giving it back. We keep giving it back. Because you said that you were homeless in 2003 and then homeless to 2013. That's a 10-year difference. I'm sure there was some kind of cycling in there of trying to do it on your own. And then boom, you're right back into the same predicament you were in because nothing's changed, right?
Yeah. But homeless cycles between, let's say, 2001 and 2013, it was really weird because it was exactly the same. It was just in a different area. Like, one was in New York and it was scary, dark, and lonely. And in Utah, it was scary, dark, and lonely, but the crowds were totally different. Like Tweakerland, I swear to God, Tweakerland in Salt Lake City is a whole different vibe than Tweakers in New York City. Like it was wild because the Tweakers I was hanging out with in New York were still all like DJs and club promoters and like kind of had something going for them as far as like club world. And in Utah, it was like everybody was out boogling and whose life were we going to destroy tonight? Because we got to steal and rob whatever's in somebody's garage, whatever's in their car, whatever I can get my hands on. Like real, the things that that people teach you about, I learned about in Tweakerland in Utah. Like it was the most bizarre thing. In New York, people were my friends. When everybody just wanted to love each other and have sex with one another. And in Utah, it was like, we are robbing anything that gets in our way. It was really ugly, but different. Winters, I had a couple of winters homeless in Utah where I'm like, Utah gets really bad snow. And it was probably the last snowiest winter Utah had was my last year of homelessness. And I remember the snow was this thick. I had 3 suitcases. I'm like freezing, sleeping at bus stops, squatting in houses that had no heat. And it was awful. When I found recovery, I got into doing street outreach and working in tent cities. And it was like such an eye opener because half the people that I was kicking it with in my addiction were now living in these downtown tent cities, freezing. That I knew had I not gotten sober when I did, I'd be sleeping in a tent, wondering who was going to invade my tent that night. Like super scary. Cause I don't know what tent cities looked like in New York. That wasn't something that happened to me, but that's where I was and would be today had I stayed using in Utah. Like it was scary.
So in Utah, this is where you started. This is where you found recovery.
Utah is where I found recovery. Like, I don't pride myself on this, but I'm grateful. I heard somebody saying it the other day, like, I just assumed as long as I wasn't using in front of my children, I wasn't hurting them, right? Out of sight, out of mind. And I got really lucky. Like when I got pregnant with my first kid, which was in New York City, it must have been 2006. I just knew I wanted a better life for my kid. And I don't want to say I was raised better because that's just not the truth. Like I think I was tired of the life I was also living and I didn't want to kill my child. I had miscarried just a couple weeks before. And so that was like really losing one child and then having another. It was like I knew God wanted me to have my oldest. And so I got sober for a couple of years with having my 2 kids back to back. So like 2007, until 2009, I stayed off the drugs, but I still drank. Alcohol is the worst drug of all for me. I always keep thinking like I can drink, but I'm not the kind of drinker that drinks and doesn't get high. I might drink for like 2 or 3 days without getting high, but by day 3 or 4, when I'm now on to like a full 5-gallon box of wine, because that's how I drink, and that big old cheap box of wine that's supposed to last me 2 weeks is gone. By like 4 hours later, I'm on a straight meth bender every time. And I don't come home until I'm in jail. Like, I just don't. So in 2017, I was super tired. It was an awful summer, again, with my suitcases. I wanted to get sober. My girlfriends and I, like, I'll never forget this. We would sit, like, we were into bath salt at that point. And a couple girls and I, we would sit and cry. Literally, meth and bath salt are such emotional drugs. Like, dude, I have seen the hardest, toughest men cry coming down off of meth. It's insane. But we would cry as we're like hitting the foil or the pipe saying, why aren't we with our kids? Like our kids deserve better. And we just couldn't get there because the drug was so overpowering in the lifestyle. So July of 2017, I come to my parents' house. I'm like sick of all the bullshit, sick of sleeping on the side of buildings, sick of everybody stealing all my stuff. Like my friends stealing all my stuff and then making up lies because they're in hallucinations and in psychosis that I'm working with the feds. And it's like, I'm getting the shit kicked out of me because I just made a deal with the feds trying to get the dealer hemmed up. Meanwhile, I'm like, I'm just paying homeboy back for the money he fronted me 2 weeks ago. How was that working with the cops? Just craziness. Craziness.
That's reality right there. I'm telling you right now, it's always working with the cops, always working with the feds. Like I had the same stuff happening, and I wasn't even on meth. I was just shooting up, smoking dope, but smoking crack and doing pills, and I would get blamed for the feds. And I'm taking apart, doing something with batteries and some other stuff. And I'm like, I have no clue what's going on right now, but I'm not doing any of this that you're talking about.
Oh, dude, literally the shit kicked out of me by family, son and daughter, proving it's just insane. So I went to my mom's house. Showing up for my kids was awful. Any parent out there knows, like, when you're trying to show up for your kids living that life, it's so hard because it's okay, I got to see the kids today at 1. Wait, I got to make sure that I have drugs. So when I'm at the house seeing the kids, I can get high in the bathroom. And then 1 o'clock becomes 4 o'clock. 1 o'clock Tuesday, it's now Friday at 4, and it's like, shit, I never got to my kids. Like, the intention was there, but there was always a mission. So I got to my mom's house. I was tired. I probably hadn't slept in days in the same clothes, hadn't showered. I mean, my skin was gray. I was skin and bone, and my girlfriend and I had said, we're going to get sober this weekend, and she went to her parents' house to be with her kids to get sober. I went to my mom's house and said, I'm going to get sober. I literally slept. And you'll see it as time goes by. I have this one picture that my kids were 5 and 7 at the time. And I literally went to sleep on her couch and I didn't move for 3 days. And so my poor kids just sitting on my lap, playing with their ponies, playing with their toys, so happy that I was there. They just wanted to be around me. At the time, I was pissed because my mom took pictures to show everybody in the family, like, this is where Rachel's at. What do I do? And I had told her what I got there. I'm like, look, mom, the cops are probably going to show up, probably a warrant squad. My intuition just told me, like, they were. I'm like, it's the weekend. If the cops do come, please don't answer the door. I promise I'm going to get better. I, to this day, don't know if my mom called the cops or if they just showed up. I don't know. But I remember hearing the doorbell ring and my 5-year-old saying, mommy, mommy's here. Yeah, my mommy's here. And I just remember thinking, who the fuck is here right now? And I opened my eyes up from a literal 3-day slumber, and it's 3 police officers. And I'm just like, I'm going to jail again. Just got out, but here we go. And the cop was really cool. He didn't arrest me in front of the kids. They walked with me. My parents had a really big house, so they walked me around the corner, and they didn't put handcuffs on me. But that was it for me. Like, my kids were always, they weren't in my addiction with me. I just didn't show up. And at this point, they saw the cops come and get me. And they were definitely, nobody ever let me talk to my kids on the phone. I always called from jail, hoping on Mother's Day. I can't tell you how many Mother's Days I was in jail calling, wanting my kids to tell me Happy Mother's Day for Mother of the Year, right? The one who doesn't show up but does call when you're in jail for a Mother's Day blessing. Like, and then I would be so hurt that I couldn't get that. But that was like the straw that broke the camel's back, the rock bottom of all rock bottoms. Like, getting beat up, getting raped, getting robbed, getting this. Those weren't big enough rock bottoms, but my kids seeing me get arrested, I just finally got sick and tired of being sick and tired. And my mom has always been the, if you go to jail, don't call me. I'm not answering the phone. Don't expect a visit. You're not getting bailed out. And she answered the phone this round of me being in jail. And so that 30 days I was there, she was so rad. She knew, like, God told her this was it. And so she put $10 on my phone every week, and she gave me $10 in commissary, which was gold. It was enough for coffee and honey buns. And I didn't have to talk to anybody. I just read my Bible. I started doing Bible study in there. I was going to church. I always did program. Like, when you're in jail, you always go to the AA groups. You always go to whatever you can do to get out of your cell, because you just need to be done from pacing, playing pinochle, and looking at everybody else who can draw when you can't. So I was like, I knew something had to change at this point. So I started hanging out with the people that were, in my opinion, were like Jesus lovers. And I thought they were weird, but I'm like, so what's all this about? And I got out and I'm here today, 6 years later, we're continuing to work a strong program. But I knew at that point, like when you go into the rooms and people will start telling their story, they always say, I finally became willing to do whatever it takes to get sober. And I finally understood what that meant, because I always thought I was willing. I would go to meetings. I went to IOP 500 times. I did what the courts told me, but I wasn't like fully invested. And when I got rid of the friends and I stopped hanging out at the places, and I realized I've got to put my recovery first, and whatever that looks like, that's what I have to do. Putting my kids first, putting recovery first. It made sense. And I never was willing to do that before. Like I always thought I could have alcohol as my crutch, right? Like I'm going to get rid of the drugs, but I'm not going to stop drinking, because why would I stop drinking? Everybody could drink. So I did all the things. Like I had to really look back. And this is one of the things that when I mentor people now, I'm like, that are chronic relapsers, it's like, what are the common denominators? What is it that you're doing that always brings you back? Or what is it that you're not willing to do that you keep doing every time? What are those things? And what do they look like for you? And I had to realize I was my problem. I got to stop blaming my dad for my childhood. I have to stop blaming my kid's dad for the abusive relationship. Accountability became the biggest part of like how I got sober. Stop blaming everybody. What did you do? Why are you here? Because it, and it was all, that was like a slap in the face. What do you mean? This was my fault? My traumatic childhood was my fault? All the rock bottoms were my fault? They sure the fuck were.
It's not necessarily all the stuff that's happened, right? We can't control what people's done, but it's what we do after the fact. How, like, my childhood is my childhood. That was happening before I was 10 years old, right? I'm in my 20s and 30s, still playing the part. So I feel right. It's mostly we have to understand what is our part in our own trauma, because we took that and we created our own that we created on our own. And I feel like it's a two-part process to actually working on it. We have to forgive, and we have to actually forgive ourselves for putting ourselves through the same trauma that we're replaying over and over and over from our childhood.
Nobody gives a shit about what happened to you when you were 3 years old, 40 years ago. Nope. 40 years ago. Grow up and move on.
Time to wake up. Let's go.
If you're still crying about something from 20 years ago, that's on you. You're not, you know, and my kids always laugh because they're, I always say, you grow through what you go through. They're like, shut up, mom. I'm like, you have to grow through the things you go through. But I found power in that. Stop being a victim. Stop blaming. Hold yourself accountable. Heal and help others heal. And that became really powerful for me. And learning that, like, I had to, when I got sober this time, it was like, okay, so what were all the things that I needed that maybe would have helped me not have to try to get sober for literally almost 20 years. From 2003 to 2017, I was trying to get sober that whole entire time. So what were the things that I needed to do that? And that's how I realized, like, that was the beginning of my recovery advocacy work and figuring, what is it like? Maybe if I had health insurance, I would have gone to rehab. Maybe if I knew how to go to detox, maybe I would have went and detoxed. Maybe if I knew what trauma healing was, and how does somebody with no insurance get it? How does somebody with insurance get it? And that became like something that I took a lot of pride in, because it was like, I don't know if I would have known those things. Would I have gotten better? Probably not, because I still thought I could drink alcohol. And some people can, right? I don't judge whoever's program, but alcohol was always my problem. So maybe if I knew how to go to detox, maybe without being court ordered to go to a program, maybe those things would have helped me. And that is what I do today. Is I take, I don't know the resources here in Tennessee, but in Utah, I was a professional. Like, everybody in the state was like, hey, Rachel, how do I go here? This person has this insurance. What program will help this? What if they're marijuana friendly? Who does this? Where can they go if they're in the drug program? Early in my recovery, I was able to do a lot of that nationwide. And then I realized, like, why am I doing stuff for people all over the country when I could do it right here in my own community and, like, physically take people and help them? And not that it's not good to do it nationwide. Of course, that's the dream. But I found real growth when I started to do it inside my physical community, which to this day, I know that's what got me sober. I wouldn't be who I am today had I not been able to be the advocate I was then. And a lot of really good things happened to me in my recovery. But over the past 6 years, I've also really got to grow through a lot of things that people relapse over. I lost my dream job and it put me into this crazy depression. And I got through that sober. I've had an awful breakup. Like, it was the Cinderella story for me and turned Nightmare on Elm Street. And it was awful. And I learned how to go through a breakup sober. And that was really hard because it was like, holy cow, those real feelings, like, no wonder people drink and get drunk and commit suicide over breakups. They were hard. And I lost my best friend. I've lost multiple people. A lot of death has happened. And I've learned over the past 6 years, like, I can get through hard emotional things as long as I continue to go back to the basics and use the tools that I learned throughout all the years of attempting sobriety and the ones where I have actual recovery. And that's been really powerful because there are things that are really hard. Friends turn on you. People you thought were your best friends are not. And life gets lifey and work weeks get hard, especially in this field. Compassion fatigue is real. And finding out that I can go through all those things and do them sober has probably been the most rewarding and scary because it's, you realize just how easy it is. Like, I don't think about drinking anymore. I don't have drug dreams really. I mean, occasionally they come, but retraining the brain to, I can get through hard things is, I don't even know how you'd explain it. It's interesting because we get through them and we get through them sober, but the addict mind is like, a drink would really help that. A 3-day bender would be really nice here. And it's like, you ain't getting me this time, bruh.
<laughs> You know? <laughs> Not today, Satan. Not today. Not today. Yeah. <laughs> Yeah. And it's not our solution these days. We look for the next level of growth and we look for the solution to be in, okay, what's this teaching me? How can I grow from this? That's the beauty of recovery, I feel.
Yeah. People, places, and things. I learned too, like when I had moved back to Utah in 2012, those same kids that I was getting in trouble with in high school, I had found at a bar and went right back into using. It is so important to really be aware of the people who you hang out with, because as strong as you think you might be, one night out with people you used to get high with could become, for me, a 5-year bender. And I always still think that's crazy because I never in a million years would have thought that one night meeting old friends at a bar 20 years later was going to put me back into the back part of my addiction and end up homeless. And it did. It was wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Rachel, I appreciate you coming on here and sharing your story. What is your relationships these days with your dad, with all these people that you've had these, I guess, resentments towards, because that's what we're bringing into. That's what kept us out there for so long from what the traumatic experiences. What's your relationships like these days with all those people that you had to forgive?
I'll tell you that my dad and I have had a really hard relationship since I was a teenager. And there was a lot of blaming and a lot of hurt. And I think about 3 years into my recovery, my dad and I both were able to forgive each other. And we have the best time ever now. The best time ever. We laugh. We joke around. He tells me he's proud of me. He hugs me. He tells me he loves me. I do the same. And it's heartfelt. But it took time. My twin sister, I hurt her a lot. And it took her about 2 years. We hung out, but we didn't talk on the phone like we used to. And I think it took a couple years. It was not, I'm sober, everybody forgive me and let's all be happy. It took a couple years to build the trust back and then to get through the actual amends and the realness of it. But now I'm friends with everybody in my family. Like, I can say that we're friends, we forgive, we fight, we apologize, and we get through it. But I'm not blaming anybody for my mistake. We don't even talk about that anymore. There's no more at the dinner table. You used to, because now it's just, last night you pissed me off. Why'd you hang up on me? It's just normal conversations. We spend every single holiday together. There's no more fighting. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. That's... like today, last year, and this year, I would say, are the real beauties and joys of what long-term sobriety brings to families.
That's awesome. I'm so grateful for you for coming on here. Thank you so much for sharing your story.